Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, February 22nd, Alan and Joe spoke with immigration attorney and partner in the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, counterterrorism expert and best-selling author Malcolm Nance, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post.
The breaking news is the Supreme Court cleared the way for a New York prosecutor to obtain former President Donald Trump's tax returns, dealing a massive loss to Trump, who has fiercely fought to shield his financial papers from prosecutors. The documents will be subjected to grand jury secrecy rules that restrict their public release. So, Alan and group, what does this ultimately mean? What can we extrapolate from this information? The former president obviously worked very hard to keep these from being released. So now what?
I tell you the truth. I tell you what I think is the truth. Two possible reasons. Number one, it was just a power play on his part. He didn't want anybody pushing him around. He was going to show them all that he could do whatever he wanted and not release his returns. On the other hand, there may be something in there that is so damning and so impossible that it may by itself stop him from running for president another time, which he continually says he's going to do. And that's, I think, an appropriate way of doing it. Malcolm?
Yeah, I think that although this is going to be interesting, and I really do believe the Supreme Court held this up until after the inauguration deliberately.
Sure.
They could have released this last November or October. And so they still played a political game with it. But as this information goes into, you know, the New York State law enforcement and goes up into a grand jury and gets analyzed by this new hire that Cy Vance has, who is the head of a racketeering corrupt influence organization investigator, I think it'll take quite a long time. New York State's vested interest in this is pretty simple. Trump declared his properties were worthless on paper, and then he went to investors and sold them, declaring they were extremely valuable. And that gave him the ability to cheat the state out of tax money. So it's the Al Capone theory, right? His accountants are the ones who are going to get him. But I think it won't be as cut and dried as we want. It sort of has taken on the old Hillary Clinton emails trope, where everyone wants that thing to happen. I don't want to see his tax returns. I want to see the state of New York use those tax returns to bring him to justice.
Yes, but if the grand jury, right, Malcolm, if the grand jury indicts him, we're going to see those. We the people will see the returns.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you know what? If they indict him, they're going to be indicting all his kids. They were part of this scheme. We know that from the Trump Foundation investigation, that they were neck deep in everything. The same way that his father was depositing money into his account when he was 3 months old, $100,000 at a time as a tax dodge, we're going to find that with his kids. And you know what? The way that Donald Trump Jr. and Ivanka and all the rest behave, that will open up new investigations. And, you know, no better group of people deserves it.
Sienna.
Malcolm summed that up very well, but I will say that you have to remember that, you know, a convicted felon can run for president again. So the question is, how will this impact him, his political standing? I have no question that he'll be brought into court, that he'll have to, you know, go in front of a court and defend himself. But I don't know how that will affect his political standing and his effect on the Republican Party. That's what I think about those long-term implications.
Well, and it really depends on what's in there, right? I mean, of what, as Alan indicated, of what we're looking at, of what's being hidden. Libby.
I'm giddy. I'm sort of doing a little dance over here.
I like it when you're giddy.
Let's be real. I mean, you know, this is the beginning of the end, and this, on top of the lawsuits, the private and public lawsuits around the insurrection, the targeting that of his of Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and all the rest of them. You know, this just is one more swish in circling the drain. And yeah, it might take a little while, and he'll do all he can to dance around this. But the fact is, the Supreme Court has ruled, and he's going to have to do it. And if he doesn't, he'll be held in contempt, and he could go to jail just for that alone.
Alan?
Yeah, so, but you know, when you say the beginning of the end, Libby, the beginning of the end, at the end, was losing the election. Now we're going to we're going to get mail, right? We're going to get mail now. It's going to say, "What are you talking about Trump for? Biden is the president now." Okay, I'll try to give you my answer, although I'm not the whole show here. My answer is we're talking about it because this guy almost brought us into fascism in this country and totalitarianism, and that's what he was trying to do. Hey, we better learn from it, and we better talk about it. And if it turns out he was a crook during all of this, this just adds to the story.
And it's not like we're we're promoting a Trump story of him going out and rallying his troops and putting him on a pedestal. You know, I'm sure Fox is now saying he's being victimized. But this is a legitimate news story. This isn't what we talked about last week of whether or not you want to give him more airtime just for breathing. This is a legitimate news story that will need to be covered and will be covered because it is going to be one of the downfalls of the other guy, as Joe Biden calls him, of the orange menace. And, you know, I think it's worth covering. It's not like we're saying reelect him president. That's not this at all. That's not what this is about. This is about him using the office as well as everything that he's always had to break the law, to evade paying taxes, to put himself above the law. And it's worthwhile coverage.
All right. I want to go to just a couple more, things. And one of them is Merrick Garland, who is now on Capitol Hill testifying to become Attorney General of the United States. So, Alan, what do you think of his chances here getting through?
Oh, no, he'll get through. I don't think there's any question he's going to get through. They have the votes. The Democrats have the votes. You know, even that stinker from West Virginia isn't going to interfere on this one. On the other one, yes. That way he has his creds with his right-wing constituency, even though he's a Democrat. But no, I think Garland goes through. You know, he's the president's choice. How could you deny him?
Sienna?
I think he's going to get through, and I'm excited about Judge Garland. I was excited about him 5 years ago. I'm excited about him now being Attorney General. We really need him right now. As we know, he was one of the prosecutors for the Oklahoma bombing. So I think he's going to do a really good job leading this charge against what happened on January 6th and also his dedication to civil rights. I'm excited about Judge Garland a lot.
Libby?
I can't wait for an attorney general who will actually do a job.
Yeah, but he's got a problem, right, Libby? And his problem is this. The other guy so politicized the office and who ran at the last minute, of course, Barr. But he's got to show that he is not going to be a political actor, that he is going to do the job.
His tenure on the federal bench, I think, you know, underscores his ability to do that and to not politicize the office. And, you know, I think the Dems will ask him these questions. The Republicans will ask the questions, and it'll be so disingenuous. But I think he'll get approved and it'll go through. It'll make the Republicans look foolish, given everything that's gone on. The fact that they're losing support around the stimulus package, not that the two are related, but they are. More and more people want the stimulus package to go through, including the Republican base or part of the Republican base. Those who are leaving the Republican Party, I guess, is what you can say. So the fiscally conservative folks with a brain, they want this stimulus package to go through. They want government to get back to normal. They want an attorney general who's going to go after criminals and not do a president's bidding. And I think that that's what will happen. And I think Merrick Garland's history and record speaks for itself. And I might be being a little, pie in the sky about this, but it'll be bad for the Republicans if they try to stonewall this.
Well, what they're going to do is obviously go for ask the most embarrassing questions they can find, like, Biden's son and Hunter, and maybe even go back to Hillary, and those are the things he's going to.
Will you go after them? Will you go after them is going to be the question.
Yes,
and the answer will be if there is reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know what? That's where they get us. And the Republicans have politicized the attorney general's position to make him a personal attack dog of mm-hmm. the president. So now they're going to try to characterize through this hearing, and I've got it on screen. they haven't gotten the questioning. But they're going to characterize it that he is Joe Biden's attack dog and that he will ignore Hillary and all the rest, and they will – he's going to turn out to be what we know he's going to be, which is a generally good person who will answer those questions in such a way that it will be neutral. But for the Republicans, it'll be a knife against us that, if I find something about Hunter Biden, I'll investigate it. Yeah, if I find something about Hillary, equal justice under the law. This is a guy who's going to walk in and he's going to have every inspector general in every major office of the executive do reviews and find that there were a lot of crimes going on. You know that there were people making money during this. They fired most of the the inspector generals. And those guys are going to come in and they're going to start forwarding criminal charges up to the Justice Department. And the Republicans are going to hammer us with the fact that the attorney general is actually doing his job.
But on the other hand, in terms of this hearing, Merrick Garland, if they raise Hillary, if they raise Hunter Biden, Merrick Garland can simply say, well, Attorney General Barr didn't find anything and didn't go after them.
Well, that's one thing they could do. He could also say, look, I'm not in the office yet. I have to study everything.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. what he will say.
Malcolm, you were going to say something other?
No, that she had a good comment.
Okay, excellent.
Oh, thank you.
I love when you all get along. That makes it so much easier. All right, let's go.
It's so
to,
rare.
Yeah. Let's go to the Biden immigration plan. And a reminder that Sienna is watching this and an expert on this, so we'll go to her. The proposal unveiled by Democrats on Capitol Hill offers an 8-year path to citizenship for most of the 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, eliminates restrictions on family-based immigration, and expands worker visas. Senator Ted Cruz's decision to fly to Cancun as Texas was battered by a storm sparks an outcry. I'm not sure what that has to do with one, but anyway. So rolling out the immigration plan, offering an 8-year path to citizenship. We're here today because last November, 80 million Americans voted against Donald Trump and against everything he stood for, said Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, said at a virtual news conference. They voted to restore common sense, compassion, and competence in our government. And part of that mandate is fixing our immigration system, which is a cornerstone of Trump's hateful horror show. So, Sienna, let us begin with you and your thoughts on that language.
It was. And so what I will say is that this bill is ideal for my clients, for immigrants coming into the country. It has a lot of good benefits to the immigration process, but here's the problem. When the Trump administration started its policies in the Department of Homeland Security, it started day one with the Muslim and travel ban. And he just hammered at the immigration system for the last 4 years, constantly hammering, constantly putting in regulations and policies that hampered an individual's ability to become a green card holder, to enter the U.S., to file asylum. And we have been dealing with this for the last 4 years. And I think the problem is on January 20th at 12:01 p.m., I started getting calls from clients and people around the community wanting to know, you know, what has changed? I'm hearing that Biden's going to change this. And what we've seen so far and realistically is there's been a lot of review right now of Trump's policies, but we haven't seen any concrete changes. And we are still, as an immigration attorney, I feel we are still practicing under Trump administration policies. And that's problematic. So we think the bill is a great, you know, everyone in the community is excited about the bill. Everyone in the community thinks there's really good things that could happen with the immigration bill. But we've all been here before with comprehensive immigration reform.
Right.
We've all seen other administrations try to get this through. And so what we really want to see from the Biden administration, and more importantly, from the future attorney general as well, who impacts the immigration court and the laws and policies there, are we trying to see feasible, tangible rollbacks of what happened.
Alan?
Well, you know, there's a very inconvenient question here. You know, most of us who are thinking people, I think, just think what's happened with immigration and our immigration laws and Trump taking advantage of the situation to be, horrible. But the real question is, how do the American people feel about this? I suspect Trump was playing on this because, you know, there are a lot of people who say, pull up the gangplank. I'm the last one in. We don't want anybody else here. Now, we have a fairly liberal panel, I think it's fair to say. But you better believe that there is this issue as to what people are thinking about, you know, opening up the borders again.
I will push back on that, Alan, just to say a lot of people who thought they wanted to push to, you know, put the wall up are seeing the benefits of immigration over the last 4 years.
Yeah,
I have dairy farmers and people in Saratoga who, what you would say is they're pretty conservative or very moderate, who now don't have workers. They can't find anyone to milk their cows.
Yeah.
They can't find anyone to work in Saratoga.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing this switch because people are starting to understand the underpinnings and the importance of immigration in the U.S.
Well, Sienna, let me push back against what you're not against what you're saying. I would be delighted to see the immigration laws, the immigration process reformed and let people come into this country. I think it's where we've always lived. I'm just wondering whether or not when the polls are done, you're going to see, even though there are specific groups, as you say, who benefit from using immigrants, as I always have, on farms and places like that, whether or not that transcends to the whole American people. I'm just trying to think this thing through, that's all.
Malcolm?
I feel strongly both ways. you know, the funny thing is, as you know, I monitor these right-wing forums in real time. I get up at 3 in the morning and I listen to watch their Telegram channels. And the immigration, the policy of allowing people to petition in the United States, separating the, you know, bringing the children back to their parents, canceling the wall contract, that is just now starting to pick up steam, only in light of the Texas power outage. There's a lot more activity going on with regards to, by the way, as you, someone made a previous comment about AOC, they believe AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they believe she caused the power outage. And in their crazed minds, the Green New Deal is actually policy and legislation, and it collapsed the Texas grid. Mm-hmm. So that's where most of their thoughts are. They really haven't shifted back to immigration. But believe me, come Sunday, Donald Trump at the Conservative Political Action Committee is going to hammer that America's under attack. And I wouldn't be surprised if you suddenly start seeing caravans pop up in the Central America and start heading to the United States. There was a lot of suspicion 3 years ago that these were actually being paid for by business interests in Latin America. And there's some evidence to that effect. So we'll see it all come back.
Malcolm Nance on the Roundtable panel on Monday, February 22nd. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel of the Week in review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. For Thursday's panel, Alan and Joe were joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Icarius-Kelly, and Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld.
Let's talk about the post office for a few minutes. This is always an interesting story and something that people are invested in, whether you want to be or not, right? You need the post office. So here we go. President Biden has nominated three to the USPS, United States Postal Service, Board of Governors, as DeJoy testifies on the mail crisis. So this from the Washington Post, the White House move toward reasserting control of the United States Postal Service on Wednesday, even as its Republican Postmaster General defiantly told Congress he would press forward with plans to raise prices and slow the mail, brushing off calls for him to resign. President Biden named two Democrats and a voting rights advocate to fill three of the four openings on the Postal Service's governing board, according to three people briefed on the discussion and later confirmed by the White House. If all three win Senate confirmation, the nine-member board would be made up of equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans, with McReynolds, whose organization is a darling of the left-leaning groups, as the lone independent. The new slate would create a Democratic advantage and potentially the votes to oust DeJoy, whose summer overhaul led to precipitous service declines that snarled up untold numbers of Americans' bills, prescriptions, and paychecks. DeJoy, with the current board's backing, slashed overtime and dramatically reduced mail processing capabilities, moves deemed by an inspector general's audit to reflect a lack of preparation or concern for how they might affect service. So that is what we're going with here, Alan.
I can't wait to see this guy go, and I'm sure he will for all of us, and that includes me, who has waited weeks and weeks for a letter that should have been, you know, come to us the next day. This guy has ruined the post office, and as far as I'm concerned, he ought to be kicked out and is with as hard a boot as absolutely possible. What a jerk!
Well, this guy certainly is no Ray Heatherton, who people of a certain age will remember was the merry mailman on TV.
I remember him well, yeah.
He is a hard ass, and he comes across that way. And I agree with Alan's assessment. But that said, he was put in there largely because he had a bottom line guy reputation, and the post office is in serious financial trouble. I think I read nearly $2 billion with a B dollars in liabilities, for obvious reasons. I mean, there's less mail going out now, and the expenses are still very high. So they brought him in there to trim the fat. But I think what the critics of the post office have not entirely grasped is how important the Postal Service is in this country. And I suspect that of the many agencies around this country, the Post Office is one where the general public is mm-hmm. supportive of it. It wants it to continue. It performs a service. So I think that on the one hand, I'll agree that this guy is a hard ass and bad news. On the other hand, he is trying to trim the expenses, and I think they need to give him a different direction. Drew, do the best you can to continue to do good service and find places to make some cuts if it's possible.
I know the right direction, out the door.
I would have to agree.
I mean, look, let's face it, if we are in a place where the Post Office is costing too much money, pay the bill. It's worth doing.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't want you to think I'm defending him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. Vera.
Yeah. So I wanted to comment on two things, and Ira went that direction as well. And I agree with what both Alan and Ira said so far. The Post Office is absolutely essential, particularly in its services to rural and more remote areas. I mean, post offices in small towns, at least pre-COVID and will again post-COVID, serve as a networking center. People go there to chat with each other, to get information. There are boards where you post information, you pick up your medicine, you pick up your bills, and you mingle with members in your small community. You drive into town maybe once every 3 days or so. This is a way to connect the rural areas to the city. The post office plays an exceptionally important role in that sense, a social role for the common good. And the idea to destroy it, to weaken it, and to turn it into a business venture is appalling to me. In addition to that, I wanted to point out that the morale among postal workers is very low. This DeJoy has taken all the joy out of people's labor.
Darn, I was going to do that.
People had a sense of pride in their work. And now they're basically, you know, I mean, the emergency measures in terms of postal workers having to work at night, on the weekend, to deliver, to hunt down packages and letters that are misplaced. I mean, it's mayhem in the system. And that is because of DeJoy.
Malia Dumont.
Haven't mentioned, but it has been said in many circles that part of DeJoy's marching orders was to diminish confidence in the Postal Service so that confidence would be diminished regarding elections and mail
and
voting,
right.
Et
cetera. Yep.
Malia.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah, I live in Kingston, and right around Christmas time was talking to my local postman, a very nice guy, hardworking, and it was 10:30 at night, and he was out delivering mail, and he said, I can't continue to live like this. He was emblematic of the larger morale issues that Vera just alluded to. But I think it's also, obviously, this is a demonstration of the scope of Trumpism, that even an organization that's, widespread across the country that's focused on logistics can manage to be politicized, despite the fact that it has a governing board that's large enough to try to avoid politicization, even despite all of those structural things that are put in place to avoid politicization. It's the post office, too, has become part of this larger political question. So I really hope that DeJoy can be ousted and we can get back towards a post office that's focused on its work instead of being politicized.
I don't understand. Can someone tell me that this idea that that you are intentionally slowing the mail doesn't make sense to me? I mean, it would seem to me, even under whatever circumstances you're dealing with, you wouldn't say, oh, what we need to do is slow things down, especially if you're trying to help the overall fiscal picture of the post office. Does anyone want to take that?
Well, they wanted to slow things down so that the elections would not come in on time.
I'm sorry. It was Ira, go ahead.
The election could be the primary reason why he would want to slow the mail down.
Right,
but when he says we're going to have to raise the rates, and in addition to this, service will be poorer, that doesn't quite add up in any business.
Yeah.
I think your point, whoever made the point just now, whether it was Ira or one of the other people, this election was run and probably won based on, mail-in ballots. And I think an awful lot of people suspected that Trump was opposed to trying to do anything to slow down the mail, because if it came in after a certain time, it would be disqualified. The rest of it in Georgia right now, I believe there's an effort to change, vote by mail. So there is a political rationale for all of this, too.
And we remember pictures of the machines that were taken off of line and destroyed, the high-speed sorting machines that occurred before the election, presumably at Trump's request.
Unbelievable.
And then also just remember in terms of public service, the simple removal of post office boxes across rural areas so people couldn't drop off mail.
Right.
They had to drive much longer. How about you have to drive for a half hour to even drop off a letter with the stamp?
Yeah,
we had
one in our corner here, and I wrote a column saying exactly that, Vera.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that people would congregate, they would stand there, they would talk to each other at the mailbox. I mean, some things are just worth it.
That's right.
I think part of the difficulty in coming to terms with this, just wrapping our minds around it, is just baldly stating that DeJoy's goal was not to make the post office more efficient and more effective. And we expect our public leaders, our government officials, to try to do the best job they can, but that's not what his goal was ever. So his goal was to lower confidence and to focus on politics. And so in that context, it's not surprising the things that he did, even though they're completely absurd, that the Postmaster General would be trying to make things more inefficient and ineffective. But that's in line with the goals that he had, the political goals that he had for this organization.
From as long as I can remember, Alan, the post office has always been referred to as a quasi-government agency. What are the problems with such quasi-public agencies? I mean, are we not seeing that develop right now?
Yes. I think the idea that people wanted their cake and eat it, and now they're figuring out what's going on. You know, you had these efforts to privatize the post office, to make it more responsive, and then all of a sudden we found out what happens when you put some of these things into the hands like of a guy like DeJoy. It's awful. So we have to learn that lesson. You know, Mario used to tell me all the time about the post office being a socialist agency, and people were saying, you're for socialism. And he would say, yeah, I'm for the post office. I'm for this, that. And he was always right.
When you think of how something like this ends, I guess I'm fascinated by putting these people on this board and having it be more equal Republican and Democrat. But if DeJoy, ultimately, it's up to him, right? I mean, even you can scream and yell that you want him to resign, but he doesn't have to.
Oh, that's right. That's right, until they fire him. And I think when Biden put these new people on the controlling board, the word fire is really written in bold print, above all of that.
All right. This is about the immigration policy of President Biden. President Biden's promise to restore the U.S.'s reputation as a beacon for the globe by reopening the nation's doors to immigrants and refugees. But he has infuriated some supporters by expelling tens of thousands of migrants, restoring an unlicensed shelter for migrant children, and struggling to implement policy changes without a full staff in place. This from the Washington Post. After barely a month in office, Biden is scrambling to explain to some Democrats that his day one promises for a gentler immigration system will take more time with health and economic crises engulfing the United States. The risks of an early political backlash for Biden are growing. Former President Donald Trump dispatched his deputies to the Hill on Wednesday to lobby against Biden's immigration overhauls, and Trump plans to blast those changes in a speech at the CPAC conference on Sunday. An Immigration and Customs Enforcement email obtained by the Washington Post shows that the administration has already entered crisis mode on the southern border. Alan.
Well, you know, Trump knew, you know, he's an evil man, but he's not a stupid man. Well, maybe he is stupid. But in any case, you know, his position on immigration was lock the doors, you know, to everybody in the United States. And they do their polling and they find out that people don't want other people in. I do. I love the idea of enriching our population. But I think from a political standpoint, Trump did what he thought would excite his base the most. And now along comes Biden. He takes a look at the same situation and he doesn't want to make a mistake. He doesn't want to open the doors to the point where everybody who wants to comes in, and there has to be provision for those folks. And that is why you better believe that Biden is testing the waters.
Yeah, so I think the Washington Post story sort of mischaracterizes the situation. Clearly, it is a crisis for the people who are at the border. I'm not sure it's really a political crisis for Biden yet. Some of the people that he's working with, allies and nonprofit organizations that are trying to support immigrants, they've also called for patience. And this is also not a new situation. The Washington Post makes it sound like there's this enormous new problem. And this goes back over a decade. Even under President George W. Bush, there's a lot of attention on people crossing the border, especially unaccompanied minor children. It was an issue the government was working on back then. And Congress at that point unanimously passed a law calling for unaccompanied minors to be released into the least restrictive settings. So it wasn't that long ago that Congress was kinder and gentler to people trying to cross the border. I think we can move back in that direction. It does take a little bit of time. It's not necessarily surprising, or it doesn't prevent immigration policy from being updated, the fact that we don't have a new director in place yet. I mean, these things will all be happening in the coming days. We want to move as quickly as possible to help the people at the border, prevent any, you know, personal crises for people who are there. But I don't think it's the political crisis that the Washington Post is calling it.
Ira.
Well, you know, the two pieces of that story in the Washington Post jumped out at me. The first one you alluded to, Joe, which was, Trump dispatching people to Washington to lobby in Congress. And then if you go farther down in that article, lo and behold, there's the name Stephen Miller, quote, the architect of Trump's immigration strategy, who briefed GOP lawmakers this week on the Biden administration's immigration changes and urged them to continue hammering away at the issue, which he said could help Republicans in the midterm elections next year. So I do think that politics comes into play. This raises quite a red flag for me, a large red flag. I don't recall, and that doesn't mean it hasn't happened, a former president, quote unquote, dispatching people to Washington to lobby on his policies. But it's clearly, if that part of it is true, and Miller's appearance certainly is true, there is a big political piece of this puzzle, and it's already an extremely complex puzzle. Immigration is not something that can be solved easily, and so the active influence of Trump's people concerns me.
Yeah, let me add a couple of things to that.
Sure.
Of course, all of these issues we have discussed are very important. The Trump lobbyist strategy is to completely undermine an immigration bill that would legalize 11 million people who are in this country and have been here for years, sometimes even a decade. The number one goal is to weaken any immigration reform. which is something that Biden promised he would do ASAP, which was an overpromise on his part, but he needed a lot of support from Latino voters. So he put out there a promise that he would address this. He has not yet firmly asserted how he will go forward on DACA. He has not yet fully disclosed how he will pursue a step-by-step immigration bill to legalize 11 million people. We also expect, as is common in the spring, a surge on the southern border. And that requires, if we want to reshift the position, to invest heavily into Central America and Mexico to reestablish business connections. And of course, we know that the current president in Mexico had a reasonably good relationship with Trump, even though, you know, he's on the far left. But that's a more complicated story. Right. We have poor infrastructure on the border, and we now know that we have many, many, many young adults or children that are unaccompanied. Still, the first success that I would say the Biden administration can tout is that the committee, the task force with the pro bono lawyers and advocates on the southern border that is supervised by a federal judge has found parents of 105 separated children this past month. That is a success because the Trump administration insisted they could not be found. The first success is 105 separated children are now whose parents are now identified. That process can go forward. Now, there's still over 500 children somewhere looking for their parents because of deportation procedures, the zero tolerance policy that Trump implemented. So these are the issues Biden has to address. I believe he has overpromised, and he will get a lot of criticism from the left because it is, as everyone pointed out, an incredibly difficult task.
I realize
agree on immigration reform.
Yeah, I realize that it is complex, and I realize that we're talking about overpromising, which I understand. But it brings us to a core issue, Alan, that I think most new presidents have to deal with, and that is how patient are people for the guy in charge to solve really, really big problems?
The question, as I have said before, is one of political salience. Is this issue the kind of thing that will get somebody to act in a political fashion the same way as COVID, for example? Now, you know, I think that's what's perplexing the Biden administration. They don't know which way to go. There's the right thing. Look, my father was an immigrant. My mother was one generation away. The whole country is a nation of immigrants, as we know. If the president can't sell that to the American people, which is, let's remember where we all came from, because that's a part of this. If he can't sell that, he's doomed, or she's doomed, whoever it is, you know, at the time. So it's one of those amorphous kinds of issues that really is going to drive Biden and every other person in that office nuts.
Go ahead, Vera.
Yep. I wanted to just comment on another issue. There is absolutely no way that the flow of migrants and refugees from Central America to the United States will slow down. We have environmental conditions that are worsening. We have the dry corridor in Central America. People can't sustain themselves. They can't make a living. Then you have violence. Then you have poverty. These are issues that need to be addressed systematically across borders. That is something that should be part of the, you know, whole environmental and infrastructure discussion. Regional approaches. That is something the Biden administration has not yet discussed. It is essential. Otherwise, these problems will not be resolved.
You mean publicly discussed because know what they're doing.
I'm not privy to his private conversations, so I'm saying publicly there hasn't been any initiation of those kinds of thoughts.
There are other things the Biden administration can be working on, too. Immigration is obviously such a a broad issue, and the southern border is not the only place where Trump had terrible, really detrimental policies. He also launched all kinds of attacks and tried to weaken some of the visa system. And so Biden can reverse some of those decisions, some of the ways that Trump tried to make it more difficult for people to get visas. Those things he can do a lot more easily and quickly. And I expect to see action on that a little bit sooner than some of the action on the border.
Malia Dumont on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, February 25th. We'll be back with a portion of Friday's show after this. Welcome back to Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. In addition to Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue, Friday's panelists were former EPA Regional Administrator, Visiting Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Ank, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
A lot going on in the world, as always, and we try to figure it out together. So I want to start on the minimum wage story. So the House is expected, a key Senate official had ruled that a provision to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour had to be removed from the $1.9 trillion stimulus package. We'll get to that in a second. But the House is set to vote on the package today. And they are expected to keep the minimum wage increase in the bill over the objection of the parliamentarians. So, Alan, I will admit my ignorance of I've heard the term. I knew one existed. I didn't know the power. But tell us about the parliamentarian.
Well, the parliamentarian and this one in the Senate is supposed to be, you know, not a a partisan person, a nonpartisan. The rules on what the rules of the Senate are and says, is this allowable or not? Now, we pretty well knew, Joe, that this was not going to happen. The hint was given, broad hint was given by Biden, by the president, who said, you know, he was all for this. His constituency is all for it, and it's correct. There should be a $15 an hour minimum wage, he said, but he didn't think it would survive. So sure enough, either the parliamentarian took that as a hint, or he knew in the beginning that it wasn't going to make it. So now Nancy Pelosi can say, okay, we're putting it in over here. But in the end, there's something called a conference committee, and they're going to have to work it out. And that's where the blood will be shed.
Judith Ink.
Well, this is so important. We have to get to at least a $15 minimum wage. Yesterday, the giant store Costco announced that they're paying their staff $16 an hour. And during this pandemic moment, when everyone is applauding essential workers and these minimum wage workers go to supermarkets and retail outlets every day, literally risking their life if someone sneezes on them, the least we can do is provide enough money for people to live on. So I think the key thing for the Democrats is to keep talking about the urgency of increasing people's wages so they can live, so they can put food on their table. The parliamentarian stuff is interesting, but no one's going to follow it.
Basically, this is an appropriations bill that they are trying to tack on minimum wage language. In New York State budget making, remember, so many policy issues are included in the budget. We kind of lose track that the budget is supposed to be the budget bill to keep the state operating. But various governors have included policy measures in the state budget, and that's what the parliamentarian is saying you can't do. But it's this, I mean, if Biden does not get the $15 minimum wage, either as a standalone bill or as Alan says, through the conference committee, it would be very bad for tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, and a pretty significant early political loss for him, because he's been very articulate about the need to get to a $15 minimum wage.
I want to disagree with you on one level, and that is from day one, he was saying this wasn't going to end up in this bill. It's $15. I don't think he suffers because it is there. He said it wasn't going to be there. He was for it, but he said it wasn't going to be there. And the way I'm looking at it, he sort of has his cake and eat it too. You know, he can say I'm for it, but it's not going to be, you know, in the bill itself. So he knew what he was doing.
Well, my only point, Alan, is he has to get it done, and I don't think people really care procedurally how it gets done. They just want to, you know, and there's massive public support among Republicans and Democrats alike to get to a $15 minimum wage.
And it should be done, and I'm assuming it's going to be done in a separate bill when mm-hmm. the smoke clears.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the other thing, too, is that it's the buildup to $15, right? I mean, this will be a long time between it's fully implemented, which I think is important to point out. David Soares.
Yeah, I'm in agreement here with Alan. Look, this is perhaps the most aggressive bill that we've seen come down the pike for quite some time. And I think that Biden, being part of the Obama administration, understands the urgency of the moment. I think when we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, they had to strike while it was hot, and it was not the perfect bill, but they passed it. And I think it benefited millions of people. I think he's learned from that. I think it's already been mentioned here that even in the discussion about this COVID relief bill, he indicated early on that this may not pass. And I think that was a signal for us to not be surprised by the space that we find ourselves in right now. You have three leaders that all have a clearly defined objective at the moment. You have Biden and you have Pelosi that must be caught trying to raise the minimum wage to $15. And, you know, it'll go down. I believe that it's going to be removed and it will come back as a standalone bill. But by the same token, I don't think that Biden can risk losing this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill by staying and debating the merits of one element, as important as that element is right now when we talk about minimum wage. So I anticipate minimum wage not being pushed through along with the rest of the relief package, and I anticipate that it's going to be returned back as a separate standalone bill, once again forcing Republicans to show their hands that they're not really interested in helping the average worker, and that's the narrative that Democrats try to paint on the Republicans, and they will fall for it.
Judy Patrick.
Yeah, the reality is this minimum wage proposal is dead, at least for now. They're going to have to fight this another day. It's just not possible, I think. But there's so much misunderstanding about minimum wage. I mean, there are five states that have no minimum wage. You can pay someone anything. New York has this regional minimum wage where people upstate get $12.50, and down in the city they get $15. But you know, it represents a fluctuation in cost of living, and that's what some of you hear conservatives say. Let the states decide this. This is a state issue, but The bottom line is a minimum wage, the existing minimum wage of a $7.25 yields like $15,000 or $16,000 a year. And is that enough for someone to live on? The federal poverty level for a family of four is $26,500 a year. So there's strong public support for raising the minimum wage. The proposal before the federal government at this point right now isn't to bring it to 15 this year. I think it goes to 9-something this year and gradually goes to 15 over 4 or 5 years. So I think that's what threw a lot of people off in the beginning. But, you know, let's have a debate on the merits of it, and I bet ultimately Congress is going to approve this because, again, there is strong public support for it.
Judith, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think Judy lays it out beautifully. This is an incredibly reasonable proposal, and you're not going to get to 15 an hour until 4 years or so. So I think this is an early test for the Biden administration. They know the Senate rules better than anyone. In a pandemic, we just have to increase the minimum wage, preferably, you know, sooner in the next 4 years. So many families are just holding on by their fingernails. This is just a very dire economic situation for so many low-wage workers.
I'm going to ask a very naive question, Alan, but why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to get people paid what they should be paid?
Well, there are a lot of people who don't want to do it. I mean, they're saying, I have a business, I'm holding on for dear life, I can't afford it. And then, of course, there's Trump, and that's a whole other story. And the Republicans, as you know, are tied at the, what part of the body? Maybe
hip.
The ankle.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
The hip, exactly. it's a big move for this country, and it should be done. We all know that. We on this panel know it. Nevertheless, politically, we have seen, for example, United States senators of the Republican stripe looking at incredibly popular potential legislation and saying no because they're afraid of you-know-who. I mean, I think that's part of it.
But I think the bigger part, Alan, I don't know if you'd agree with this, is just the special interest lobbying. It's, you know, the big companies that the chains that do not want to pay more wages. You know, farm workers in New York State until recently were not eligible to even get minimum wage. And you've got the agriculture lobby always pushing back on anything to increase wages. So it's formidable special interest opposition, people who fund campaigns and wine and dine lobbyists, which I think is a little harder to do in the age of COVID. But, you know, any evening in a state capitol or Washington, D.C. pre-COVID, and, you know, the alcohol and the hors d'oeuvres are flowing at all of these receptions.
Absolutely.
And that has an impact along with campaign contributions.
And remember that those very lobbyists you're correctly singling out are basically, I know somebody once got into terrible trouble for saying this, but the handmaidens of the lobbyists, and these legislators don't want to lose that money.
Alan Shar talk on the Roundtable panel on Friday, February 26th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.